We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started.
Hello, everyone. As usual, stay tuned to the end of the interview, where I'll give you some actionable insights that I learned from my guest. These insights are also in the show notes, and all of the show notes are over at theentrepreneurethos.com. As always, thanks for listening. Now, on to my guest for today, Perry Zhang, founder and CEO of Cash Flow Portal. Perry started working as a software engineer in 2010, working for fast-growing companies like Twitter and Lyft. 5 years into his career, having reached the position of engineering manager, he started investing in real estate. First, he bought a house and lived in it, renting out the other rooms. He repeated this a few times and gradually accumulated more properties. Ultimately, he decided to take a bigger step of investing in multi-unit property, which required bringing on investors. He found, however, the process of basic tasks like obtaining signatures and transferring money was inefficient. This led him to hire a team to develop a software program that people like himself could use. That ended up being Cashflow Portal. Perry didn't dive headfirst into being an entrepreneur. As a manager at Lyft, he could afford to invest in the company and pay employees while continuing to work. He bootstrapped the company for the first year and a half until he saw that he had a viable product. Once he started to work on attracting investors in order to grow his company, he decided it was time to become a full-time entrepreneur, and he now has a clear vision of where he and his company are headed. Now, let's get better together. Perry Zhang, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. I'm so happy to be here.
Just so happy to have you here as well. You are the CEO, founder of Cashflow Portal?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And Cashflow Portal is all about investing in real estate. I'm going to totally butcher that. So I'll have you talk about it. But what I wanted to do, which I find really fascinating, is how what you're trying to do is applying technology to raising funds for buying property. A lot of people are into that. There's a lot of stuff in the real estate development space, especially in the real estate tech space. And I'm interested in this. And I think it's just an interesting way to apply technology and, of course, all of your expertise. But before we get into all that, as I always like to say, tell us how you got to do what you're doing today.
Sounds good. I'll give a short version, maybe a median length version. I graduated in 2010, became a software engineer. Then 2015, I bought my first condo. I house hacked that condo by living in one bedroom and rent out the other two. Then I start buying more single families in Seattle. Also by house hacking them, by living in buying a five bedroom, living in one of them, renting out the other four rooms. I kept doing that for 4 to 5 houses while still working as a software engineer in a high-tech firm. Then I start buying multifamily. And on my first deal, we bought a 172-unit apartment complex, which is a large deal in Dallas, Texas. We raised $4.3 million from 70 investors. I remember sending out 70 DocuSigns for them to sign the legal contracts. They sent it back. I extract the investment amount on my spreadsheet. I countersign it. I send them the wire instructions. They wire the money. Then I send another email saying that their money has been received. Coming from a software engineer background, I felt that was very inefficient and we could do it better. The solutions at the time were extremely expensive. To pay for such a software, it's $1,000 a month, which is $10,000 a year.
Yeah, wow.
And it is for customers that have more than five properties under, and we only have one property, but it's a large one. Mm-hmm. So I decided to take things into my own hands by start developing on the software. I built a team of a very small team with three, four engineers. I still work as a full-time engineering manager in a tech company. Then about a year later, we had a good product. We were talking to customers all the time during that year to get customer feedback and whatnot and beta users. And it wasn't until a year and a half later that it started taking off. And now we are a company of 16 people, 300 syndicators on the platform, 300 customers, 2,500 plus investors, and we are growing 50% month over month. And we are at this point, we are a mid-six-figure revenue, which is pretty good in the last 6 months of growth.
Wow. Talk about finding a need and filling it. Like, this is so painful. You know, this is what I always tell people that, because I have an engineering degree too. And I always tell people that engineers are lazy. And they're like, well, what do you mean they're lazy? And I'm like, no, they're really lazy. And they're like, I don't understand. I see these guys working 12, 15 hours a day, 7 days a week, just totally like engrossed in what they're doing. And I said, yes, but if there is something that's manually done and it maybe takes an hour, mm-hmm. engineer will spend 2 days trying to automate it.
That's right. That's what I do.
Because you're right. It's like, why would I not have, mm-hmm. especially if I'm going to be repeating this over and over again. And I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because I'm doing this something similar with this company I started called The Story Funnel. And it's about how to tell stories, helping startups grow by telling better stories. And one of the things that's like, okay, we need to build some software, you know, but it's like, which software to build first? I don't know. Right. So I had to really, this was really so hard. Like I have all these manual processes I go through. I'm just cringe. I'm like, oh, another spreadsheet. So I love the fact that you sort of bootstrap this, you know, kind of side hustle. Really is a wonderful story of how, you know, there's always a lot of people always ask, I'm sure they ask you like, oh, I want to do my own company. How do I do
that? That's right.
And it sounds like the way you did it was side hustle, work at your day job until you found. So how did you come to that conclusion? A lot of people will just up and quit. Right. Mm-hmm. And I love your approach because it's something I think a lot more people should do.
That's a great question. My competitive advantage was I had a high-paying job. I was working at Lyft, which also went IPO. And I joined Lyft when there were like 300 people. And when I quit, it was 3,000 people. So I saw this 10x, you know, company growth. So I had equity and I was getting paid a lot. So I do believe that successful people, not that I am successful, but I do see that successful people are actually very risk averse. They actually do always have a plan B, but they're also very brave when they do see product market fit. And for me, my calculation was that I will not make any money for the next year and a half. My net worth will not increase. My liquidity will not increase. And if the startup doesn't work well, I will put all the post-tax money that I make from Lyft into growing the startup. And if the startup doesn't pan out, I stay where I am. I get rid of the startup and my life continues. That was my calculus in coming out with the decision. Because I didn't want to, yeah. So that was the rationale at the time. But the advantages that I saw afterwards by doing so is I never coded in this startup, which is excellent. Because the alternative is to quit my job and write that first piece of software myself. I'm not a bad engineer, but if at equilibrium, I'm not going to write code if the company is successful, then I shouldn't be writing code from the beginning. That's one. In hindsight, that's a benefit because I start with a team. I hire people first, and I have that skill set because I was an engineer manager. And now, the people that I hired from the very beginning were still with us 2 years later because they really, really liked the growth of the company. So that turned out to be a benefit. The second thing, which I only found out later, is that it really, because you're not taking anyone's money, it does relieve the pressure of that you're trying to make something work in a short amount of time. And that's not necessarily healthy because that kind of pressure could lead you into making bad choices. Whereas for me is I told myself that the startup is self-sustaining, literally, indefinitely, as long as I work at Lyft. Because I can make all my money and then put it into the startup and it has infinite run rate. I had 99 problems, but cash flow is not one of them.
Well, I mean, that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a really good point.
Right. So psychologically, I said the trade-off is the company will always survive at this rate because I can pour money into it. I have infinite amount of time. It's not that risky for my personal finance. And if it's successful, I can raise seed round at a much higher valuation. The downside is that I will be so busy for the next year and a half. And that turned out also to be true. And so I was sacrificing financial stability. I was sacrificing my emotional stability for financial stability. That's not a trade-off that everyone should make, but I did that decision. The third point I want to say is for a lot of people thinking about doing startup, I have this mantra that if you are not willing to put in and work 80 hours a week on both jobs for at least 6 months, you are not passionate enough about your startup. Someone told me that. I think that's true. It's true in my case. After a while, your passion for the startup actually becomes an obsession. You start thinking about it every day. And at some point, you say, I'm actually not as excited about my day job as I am about the startup. It's time to quit. But if you quit too early, it's not healthy for the startup or for yourself, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned a little bit about when you did quit. I mean, what was the calculus on the decision to quit? I mean, I know you briefly touched on it, but I'd like to hear your thought process on that because, I mean, I love that heuristic of, hey, for the next 6 months, I'm working 80 hours a week on 40 on my day job, 40 on my startup. Like, this is what's going to happen. Actually, I think that's an interesting, you know, heuristic. But then also like unsustainable, clearly, because you're like, I have no life. I have no nothing, you know, like, but again, like you're a good point. Like if it's the passion starts to be obsession, I love that. I love the way you put that. But when was the point where you're like, man, it's time to go all in on the startup?
The time to go all in is when you start seeing traction. And a lot of times I make decisions based on my intuition and heart than rather on core data. When I first started, I told myself I'll probably quit 2 years or 3 years into the business. I heard some statistics that it takes 3 years to find product market fit, or that it takes 3 years to generate meaningful revenue. I still believe that's true. I end up quitting about a year and a half into building the startup. Now, the first half of that year and a half, it was a lot of product building. The second half of that is a lot of organic growth. We did zero Facebook ads and Google ads during this entire time. We still haven't done any of ads. Mm. Everything has been this virality effect. Mm-hmm. Because when you send out the link to raise money, investors see it, they tell their friends, and then other syndicates start using it. They're just some intrinsic virality effect. When I was ready to quit, it was both the external factor and also a internal decision. External factor, I used my own software to raise money. It was 336 unit, also in Dallas, Texas. And that was a big success. And people said that your software is so much easier to use. I've used a lot of them and I can just easily sign up and create an account and go ahead and invest in your deal. Then I was in multiple mentorship group programs and my coaches start using it and their investors love it. Then the next coach start using it. Then the next coach start using it. And then as soon as I raise money, the next 2 months, we onboarded like 10 customers. And then their investors start using it. And then I thought to myself, there's so much support at this point. I cannot do this on my own. So then I quit and then raised money. But at that point, the startup was much, much de-risk compared to a year and a half ago. And at that point, I put in 500K of my own money at that point. So it was time to raise money.
Wow. Interesting. I mean, I like the fact about the whole viral and, you know, I'm a big fan of advocacy, you know, like creating rabid fans for your stuff, because they're out of all the marketing things you can do, that's the highest ROI. I can't think of anything higher than that. And, you know, this is one proof point. Like if you've got really satisfied customers and they're like, gosh, I got to tell all my buddies about this. Whoa. Like you're getting product market fit pretty darn quickly. And, you know, then it's all about the other types of strategies like organic. And you mentioned, you don't even do Facebook ads or Google ads. And, you know, I'm always of the opinion that that stuff's a waste of money until you've got product market fit and you're scaling. I mean, my thing is, and this is probably heresy, but if you're not doing seven figures in revenue, you can't play the ad game very effectively.
That's right.
I think you should spend most of your time on content and building rabid customers. And it's just so fascinating. Like, boy, what an interesting like journey so far. I mean, and for a relatively, you know, I wouldn't say, I mean, I'm sure it's a very sophisticated product, but it's like the need is so clear, right? Like you felt, this is the perfect example of, I felt this pain. It's a festering pain. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to do deals better. You're doing it better, faster, cheaper, and helping people do this. Cause I also think that the whole idea of investing in property and making it more accessible, I think creates that generational wealth that we so sorely need right now. Mm-hmm. Interesting. You mentioned your six figures now. What's sort of the plans for the future? How are you thinking about growth? And, you know, I'm just fascinated how that, cause it's like bootstrapped to here. And then you're like, what's the growth plan?
Yeah. So a little bit more color about our startup. Mm-hmm. We got into Y Combinator and I got in as a solo founder. We also raised $4 million before we got into YC. And I used Cashflow Portal to raise money for Cashflow Portal. That was super cool.
Neat.
So, yeah.
Kind of like, what is it called? What's that one platform?
AngelList
or... what's it called? Carta. It's a new one.
Okay. I see.
Yeah. There's a bunch of these, equity crowdfunding platforms. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. That's really cool.
So our customer persona is a real estate syndicator and real estate investor. We will not use our software actually to help startups manage their cap table. We only care about the investors and real estate investors. So then from that sense, our long-term vision is Cashflow Portal. Cashflow is the brand. The portal is just a feature. We will have Cashflow Investing, which allows anyone to invest in any deal. Cash flow wallet, which is an extension of investing where you can put money into the wallet. Then cash flow underwriting that allows syndicators and investors to underwrite different properties. Cash flow management, cash flow KPIs that helps property managers keep track of their expenses. Cash flow lending, which should be our own lending department so that you can turn cash flow legal. So that is sort of a 5, 6, 10-year vision. The medium-term vision is that we are actually creating a marketplace, and that's taking off also like crazy, where syndicators can create biographies and passive investors can go on the site and to look for syndicators in that market, in the market they're interested in, and then just add themselves to the syndicator's database so that they can be alert of upcoming open deals that the syndicator has. In short, we are like CrowdStreet for small syndicators.
Interesting. Yeah, almost like Angel's List for real estate.
Yes.
Interesting. Wow. I mean, that's a pretty bold vision. I mean, I can see, wow, like just like connecting the dots on that is such a, it's like almost like the bundle debundle model. Like, you know, you go look at like a Wells Fargo or some big massive company, and then you just like unbundle all the features they have and you just see, okay, what's the beachhead? And it looks like your beachhead was, you know what? Small investors in real estate is such a pain in the, you know what? I had this problem. Gosh, there's got to be a better way. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I'm going to build the better way. Mm-hmm. Hmm. I like that. I like the thought process. And I think, yeah, I think a lot of founders, a lot of entrepreneurs, they sometimes just get fixated on the first product. Mm-hmm. Which fair, like you have to focus, but what part of your, like, how did you break that mold? I mean, is there something in your background that says, well, I can build this, but gosh, what else can I build? Is it just, cause a lot of people, to be honest, I talk to a lot of people, they don't have that kind of like, in 10 years, this is what's going to happen.
you know? That's a great question. I never thought of myself as a visionary. I still don't think. It might be the fact that I used to work at Lyft and I talk to product managers, and I'm always so impressed by how they could turn a chicken into a phoenix. They can talk the hell out of anything. And I always thought I was very down to earth and bottom line there and very realistic. So I don't necessarily feel that I had the vision to this 10-year vision. However, I am literally the ideal customer for my own product. I am a syndicator with 850 units. I care about raising money. I don't know who I can raise money from. I have friends who are on the other side of the table. They work in tech. You know, they make $500,000 a year as a couple in tech. Mm-hmm. They easily have $50,000 to $100,000 to invest. All they can do is put it into stock market and crypto, none of which they are very, very comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And they are desperately looking for the best allocators in real estate. If they want to invest in real estate, what do? They save up $200,000 to buy a rental property in Seattle. I can almost guarantee that $200,000 will not make the same returns as if you put it into a really good syndication in Texas with a good operator who knows what they're doing, who has the time to do what they do, and is incentivized to do a good job. Like that, I just know for sure. But the problem is that those investors cannot find these syndicators. Access is something that technology can solve, and that's something I'm good at, something that I have experience with. I know how to create technology. I was a software engineer manager, so that I connect the dots. I need it. I know my friends need it. It's very bold. It's a little bit crazy, but it's like, if I don't do this, you know, right now I have a choice. I could go up market by selling it to more syndicators, and not everything is rainbows and sunshines, right? I can sell it to a bigger syndicator. Well, guess what? Bigger syndicator want a white label solution.
Yes.
They want their brand. They yes. want their logo to be on the page. And I said, I could either create a marketplace or I can go up market. And I decided to go to marketplace. Now, it might be the wrong decision, but nobody is doing marketplace. And maybe that there's a reason people are not doing it and I'm not seeing it. And I literally was talking to my leadership team, like I only have one other person that we're chatting, that I said, I think I will have the least regret by doing marketplace. Even if I'm successful by going up market, I always felt like we can create more value with a marketplace that would empower small syndicators to raise more money so they can do a better job on their real estate projects, which then provides financial freedom for their family and their investors. And that's a much more feel-good enterprise than trying to go up market. So I decided that I have better product founder fits in that direction. So yeah. It's not easy. It's not like this will be successful either.
Right. I like the idea of product founder fit. I had heard that before, where there's product founder fit, product skill fit, product market fit. I mean, you know, everyone's got to do all that. And what's super interesting is, you know, having that kind of core strategy. I would say it's an ethos, honestly, that says, hey, I want to help more people access this type of investment. And I want to make, because there's no reason why you can't do this. I mean, even when you invest in stocks or startups, like, you know, the government says, oh, you have to be worth $1 million. You're like, really? Like, I can't put a couple of grand in my buddy's, you know, startup and, oh, you got to be a certified investor. I mean, it's ridiculous, actually, because it's all for the people that have all the money, right? And it is really cool that, you know, you're trying to build a marketplace and build a tool and like have people have that access to, you know, generate some family wealth, generate some generational wealth for themselves. And honestly, the other thing that's interesting about real estate too, like you mentioned, you know, syndicators and people that actually know how to manage them. You know, I actually, my family owned 54 units in Lawrence, Kansas.
Okay.
Which is another kind of market, right? And so we did that as it was a family investment, you know, exactly like what you talked about, this much money down or whatever, and had someone run it. And, you know, everyone's like, why are you buying in in Lawrence, Kansas? Like, why can't you just buy in the Bay Area? And exactly, and this is the thing that was the guy that helped me with this taught me. He's like, look, for the amount of money that you can invest, you can buy one single family home or a duplex, right?
Yes.
And he's like, you're a numbers guy. Like, you got an engineering degree. He's like, okay, so let's just look at probability. You know, if you can't find renters, if you can't, like, your risk is highly variable on your input. Like, you could get a lot, don't get me wrong, and maybe it's a good idea. Yeah. He's like, but if you've got 54 of them and you have someone that manages it, you spread the risk out. And I thought, that is such a good idea, because it's true.
Yeah.
And the other thing I think that a lot of people don't understand, and I mean, I live in San Francisco and everyone hates landlords here and investors. Right. Like, they're not evil people, honestly. Right. A lot of them, you know, a lot of the environment is because of the laws that are made here. Like,
that's right.
Right. There's really not a free market here.
That's right.
But what I realized is that there's a need for housing. Mm-hmm. There's a need for, you know, I always, when I was talking to my property manager, you know, we would talk about like, we're going to raise rent. What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. How do you want to fix this? Want to fix that? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as an owner, right, I personally, my ethos was, I want a place that people are going to love, like to live. And I'm going to take care of them. I'm not going to be some, you know,
yeah.
that is normally the attitude of the small investor, the family, the people the first generation to do this.
Yeah.
When you're a massive company where all you are is a line on a spreadsheet, that doesn't happen. And you see constantly, right? I mean, this with every big company, right? As the companies get bigger and bigger, the personality, the care and consideration, you're just a bunch of number crunchers. Like it's McKinsey consultants trying to eke out another couple of $100 million or whatever, like what Peloton's going through right now. Like when Peloton said, oh, we hired McKinsey to help us, I'm like, oh, great. That's a bad move. Like they're crushed. They're done. They're going to get bought. They're done. Because what's McKinsey going to say? It's not hard. Oh, you have a revenue problem or expense problem. I mean, come on. There's no heart in that. The numbers matter, but there's the heart behind it. And do you see that with how the people that want to invest in this stuff? I'm just curious if I'm like on track or not.
No, absolutely. You point out something that I was actually writing down, that I always, my argument for between small syndicators versus these big private equity firms, there are many reasons. One will be the big private equity firms are like the McDonald's of the world. They have consistency, but it's a pretty low return. And small syndicators, they're usually very local. They are also usually like, they're like boutique restaurants with more interesting menus, and you can get to see their story. But you do have to do the work to hunt for them, and you do have to like talk to them and fill them out. And what you also point out that I know intuitively, but you put it into words, is that small syndicators also have more to prove. They genuinely care about the investors because that's all they have, right? And they also care a lot about the residents because this is their like third syndication. And they're like, I better do a better job. If I don't do a good job, it's over for me. Right. Whereas if you are a large private equity firm, you're making numbers by how much money you raise and you take a cut of the money raised. That's your job. And so I like the little guys. I like the little dogs. I do think that they create a better environment. And so the light bulb that came to me while listening to you is that if there are more syndicators in power to be able to raise money and do what they do, and there's like a checks and balance to make sure that they actually do a good job, then the tenants will actually have a better life because they're not like this like faceless machine that always raise rents because of this is the market rent. They will apply good judgment and good work and sweat equity to improve the property. So I love what you say.
Yeah, I think that's at the core of entrepreneurship too. You know, I think that's why I'm very bullish on helping as many people as possible be entrepreneurs. I really think that the local community that you serve, being, you know, a community, helping people out, like business is in general, you know, is actually a force for good. I think entrepreneurship, we're the creatives of the business world. I mean, we believe first, everyone's like, you guys are crazy. Like you're going to do what? And you're like, well, let's go. Like, some big, you know, corporate person's going to be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. You're like, yeah, where do I sign? I'm done. Right. You know? And that's the thing that's interesting is that most new jobs, net job growth are small business and entrepreneurs, businesses that have been around less than 5 years. Big corporations, net job growth is normally negative.
Okay.
Because what do? They'll consolidate. But the thing that you got that's interesting that no one seems to understand the math about this is all markets consolidate to a peak, right? It's natural. Like you look at oil and gas and even the internet, like you just see this sort of peaking, everything kind of peaks, right? And unless you have a counterbalance to that, and again, this is, you know, breaking up monopolies, breaking up oligarchies, you know, like really having the little guy have best access. And I absolutely loved your quote about technology can solve the access problem, like access technology can solve. That is 100% Spot on. And I love the fact that more and more people are trying to figure this out. There's a company that I'm familiar with called Daily Pay that one of my guys that's an NFL, a couple of my NFL player friends and guys that I work with invested in. And their basic premise is you work a day, you should get paid.
Daily pay, right?
And they are growing like a weed, like great company, right? They basically are going to put payday loans out of business because payday loans, okay, look, people need it. Don't give me like, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you're in a community, you suffer. I mean, it is an absolute horrible existence sometimes. These payday loans, they're like 35% interest. Like Daily Pay is like, they take, I think, less than single digit percentage. And it's actually the most simplest thing. It's like, if you work for a company, like you mentioned McDonald's, you're an hourly mm-hmm. worker at McDonald's, mm-hmm. you sign up for Daily Pay. Daily Pay knows you're going to get paid because it's McDonald's.
Yep.
You literally sell your debt, quote unquote, mm-hmm. to them. They pay mm-hmm. you, they go after McDonald's.
Yeah, I see.
And it's this two-sided marketplace, like what you're trying to roughly.
Right.
So, but what's beautiful, because that's what should happen. Like if someone that's working paycheck to paycheck has access to their money so they can pay their bills and not get fined or, I mean,
right.
I think right. the numbers were just like,
right.
it was insane how many like late fees and all this right. stuff, you know, and that's the little guy. And I think that's yeah. what you're trying to do with Cashflow Portal. I can really appreciate that because I do think this idea of local and this mm-hmm. idea of like connection to the community.
Yeah. Local.
So yeah. powerful. So powerful. Yeah. Wow.
I like it. Yeah. Yeah. To give an example, I have always wanted to invest in Austin, Texas. I would love to invest in an Airbnb in Austin, Texas. I just don't have the time or the network or the connections to buy the house, let alone finding an Airbnb operator to manage it. But I just like Austin. I like their coffee. I like their vibe. I feel like that's like Seattle 5 years ago, but I don't have any connections. So, you know, I would love, and you can say, well, why don't I let a private equity firm to manage that one? The thing is, I just don't trust a private equity firm in New York City to be the best operator in Austin. I need that Austin person who know the nuances of the market. I couldn't find that right now.
Right, right. No, it's the local. It's like the all politics is local analogy, right? Who would you? I mean, that's the reason why, you know, we had the property in Lawrence, Kansas. Like my property manager lives in Lawrence, Kansas. Like, yeah. mm-hmm. I don't know nothing about Lawrence, Kansas, other than my dad went to the University of Kansas for like two semesters. Mm-hmm. That's it. But the connection is like, yeah, we know the local area. We know, and that is so absolutely powerful. And I think that's mm-hmm. what I mean. You know, the U.S. has got a lot of challenges. You know, full sure. stop, right? We've got pandemic. We got all this stuff. We got this disparity, delusionment. We've got cancel culture on one end. We've got, you know, people trying to like more, you know, this freedom and the nanny state. I mean, there's all this crud basically going on, which is all like useless in one sense, but it shows a bigger problem. And I think the bigger problem is we have taken the humanity out of business and investing. And we've taken the humanity out of the basic needs of people. Like you said, some private equity firm in New York City is going to give a shit about the prop, like 52 units in Austin, Texas. I mean, maybe, but all they care about is like, it's literally a line item. How come isn't making more money? Raise the rent, right?
Right.
Whereas you don't. I love that. And I do think that we have to get more back to this local focused. And I do think technology is the way to do it. I think folks that can build the processes, build the technology, make it more accessible to as many people as possible with, of course, the safeguards and all that sort of stuff is just really, really, really important. So Awesome. Well, so what sort of questions would you have that next generation of entrepreneur ask themselves? I mean, you've answered a lot of really good, like your thought process and everything. And I'm curious, you know, someone's listening to this. They're like, God, Perry, I want to be like Perry. Like, what questions should they ask themselves? What do you think?
I don't believe who you are right now will be the person who you will be when your company is successful. So don't worry too much about your weaknesses and your defects. I never thought of myself as a charismatic person. I never thought of myself as convincing. I wish that in the first year, we did not have many customers. We were just literally having beta users. And I wish that I was more charismatic so I can talk them into using our product. And they didn't. They just like, you don't have all the must-haves I need. And that was it. Now, but then, so when you ask yourself, oh, I need the skill set, I don't have that skill set and whatnot, don't worry about it. Just do something. Even if that one side hustle turn out to be a fiasco, you at least learn something in that job. Maybe you learn how to post on Upwork and interview that freelancer, and you at least learn that one. You at least know how to build a website. You know how to do Facebook campaigns if you do that. At least you know how to build a custom domain, and you know some of the technologies behind it. The skill sets that you acquire are going to be immeasurable. So that's the first thing, is if you are afraid that you are not, you don't have what it takes, you won't by definition. So to give you an example, I got into YC and I debated for like 48 hours. I know I should take it, and we did take it. And then my friend asked me, why are you so afraid of? I said, you know, I'm afraid because if I go into YC, YC might turn me into a different person. It might make me very competitive. It might make me very cutthroat. And I don't want to be that cutthroat person. I want to be kind. I will continue to be kind. And the person said that, you know, Perry, if your company is going to be big, you by definition cannot be the same person you are today. You will grow with your company. You can still be kind. But if the company, it becomes 10x bigger, you probably also need to become 10x more formidable as a founder, period. So all the skills that you're lacking, you will grow. And so I was like, wow, that is true. Then do I want to become a more formidable founder? And then I said, well, I'm ready to be shaped and ready to grow. And that's why I joined. It's the same. Who you are today will not have the skill set almost by definition of who you will be at the end of that tunnel. You will learn a lot whether your company will be successful or not. So that will be, yeah, the biggest one is you will have self-doubt. You will think that you may have a successful job now and you will be embarrassed if it fails. It is a very rewarding journey. I can say that much so far.
Yeah, so interesting. So like, yeah, don't... If you're like, hey, I don't have the skill set, or what skill sets do I need to do it? May not have them all, but I love that. And now I love the whole growing with your company. And it's actually an interesting calculus, what you talked about. Like, I don't want it to change me. You know, I still want to be kind. And you know what? There's a huge temptation to change who you are because of the pressure to grow, right? And it comes from funneling venture capital into a company, right? I mean, they're like, why aren't you growing? And you're like, you know, why? What's YC? Grow 10% a week or some silly, I mean, some silly number. I don't remember, but I was at 500 startups. So
got it.
Similar growth hacky thing, you know, whatever. One metric that matters, whatever. You know, okay, great. I mean, we were in a digital health company, B2B digital health, where our sales cycle you measured in quarters and sometimes years. How am I going to growth hack this 10% a week? I have no idea. Right.
Right.
I mean, I was being facetious. I got a lot out of it, but,
Right. Yep. Mm-hmm.
I'm glad it didn't change you. Mm-hmm. That's great. And I love the whole kindness thing, because I think we need to have more kind founders, more kind businesses. Doesn't mean you don't want to make money. Doesn't mean you don't want to be successful, but you don't have to be cutthroat. Mm-hmm. I think that is at the core of the ethos. And that's the reason why we have, you know, have the show, try to share awesome stories from founders like you that are really living the ethos. So Perry,
appreciate that.
Yeah. Great. Great to having you on, man. Good luck with Cashflow Portal. What a solid vision, man. Like, gosh, I'm rooting for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Perry, for the great interview. Super cool what you're doing. I love your ethos. Awesome to be able to, you know, talk with someone that's got a broad, very broad and big vision. So you have a great, great big idea. So as promised, here are some actionable insights that I learned from my interview with Perry. Perry had funds to finance his startup, but he waited until he saw it could be a viable business to quit his job. This might not be an option available to everyone, but he found this strategy enabled him to start the company without the immediate pressure of having to find and satisfy investors. And yeah, all these side hustle things are legit, right? I mean, I know a lot of people that do them on the side. Now, clearly, if you listen to Perry, he had to devote a lot of time to making this work. So you got to be willing to do that if you want to work a job and build your startup. So if you have the means and the skill, it's a good way to go, right? Because you're kind of managing risk. But, you know, you got to ask yourself a couple of questions. One, can I put the amount of time in needed? Two, when am I actually going to go over to full time? A lot of investors are going to be like, hey, man, you got to be full time in this, or we're not going to put money in. So you really got to understand all that. Perry notes that by working at both a job and his company, he sacrificed emotional stability for financial stability. What kept him going was passion to the point of obsession for making his idea a reality. I mean, you heard him. Year and a half, 2 years, he was working 80 hours a week. Now, don't necessarily recommend that for everyone, but as you can see from his passion and what he was obsessed about, he really wanted to fix this problem, but he also had to make sure that he was financially, you know, stable, and he was in a good position to do that. Now, a lot of people aren't, right? If you've got a family, if you've got other obligations, you know, you need to be able to understand like the limit, your limitations. So ask yourself questions like, what are the limitations I have on myself? How much money do I actually need to survive? Can I commit the time? How long am I going to commit the time for? So these are things you just have to think about. In order to achieve your goal, you will need to become somewhat different than what you are. This doesn't mean necessarily sacrificing your values, but it does mean recognizing that you have to learn and acquire new skills to be successful. In short, move out of your comfort zone. If you fail, take the lessons you learned and move on. And it was really interesting when Perry and I talked about this, because it was this kind of realization that you're never the same person as you keep on moving through. Now, it doesn't mean that your ethics or your ethos or your morals change, but who you are 6 months from now is not going to be anywhere who you are today, at least if you're growing and nurturing yourself. So ask yourself the questions of, what do I need to learn in the next 6 months? How am I going to acquire that knowledge? You know, if I do fail, right? Failure is never an option. I mean, I'm sorry, failure can be an option, but never the final result, right? We say that all the time in the ethos. It's just a learning experience. How many of these learning cycles of learning do I need to do in order to make progress, right? So, you know, and then also, where's my comfort zone and how do I expand outside my comfort zone? So there you have it, the actionable insights that I learned from my interview with Perry. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting theentrepreneurethos.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur, and frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest you'd like me to talk to.
Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about on this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.